Welcome to The Site of the Crime, your weekly Florida and federal criminal case law update podcast. I'm your host, Jeremy Lesnetsky of Lesnetsky Guy in Law, and each week I'm going to release one episode reviewing the previous week's decisions coming out of the six Florida District Courts of Appeal and the Florida Supreme Court, and one episode reviewing the previous week's 11th Circuit Court of Appeals and U.S. Supreme Court decisions. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's episode of The Site of the Crime. Welcome back to The Site of the Crime, our federal case law edition, where we'll be talking about the 11th Circuit criminal case law updates from January 9th through January 13th, 2023. And there is a little bit of time during the holidays, the late December months and first week of January, where I took some time off on the podcast, so I apologize for that. But you might want to go back and read whatever decisions came out during that time frame. Not a whole lot of interesting decisions that came out. I think the appellate courts were taking some time off as well. But there were some that came out during that time frame. But we are back at it for the new year. Little bit of a new format where I'm going to try to be a little more conversational with the cases, but still run through them and make sure we get all the nuggets we need out of those cases. And some personal news, we had a pretty big change to our firm. We're now known as Lesnetsky Guy in Law. We practice criminal defense and immigration only. And we have offices in both Orlando and Jacksonville. Moving our offices, our Jacksonville office downtown. So that's taken up a little bit of my time as well. But if you have any, I know this podcast is mostly a criminal defense. Maybe some prosecutors out there, I don't know. Maybe even some judges. But if you do have any immigration related questions regarding any of your criminal cases, you know, please don't hesitate to give me a call, shoot me an email. Because that is what we focus quite a bit of our time on is the what we like to call crimmigration. So the immigration consequences of criminal cases or criminal offenses. All right, our first case today is United States v. Moran. This is an 11th Circuit published decision that was released January 13th, 2023. And Moran is an internet troll defense to a criminal attempt to produce child pornography case. Yes, you did hear that right. Mr. Moran would scour the internet for mom blogs where mothers of small children would post about everyday parenting things, you know, like where to buy the best diapers, what swimsuits to buy. My child wants to learn to take photographs, get into photography, you know, things like that. And Mr. Moran, for reasons that we'll probably only ever be known to him, decided that it would be a good idea to ask these moms for pornographic photos of their children on these mom blogs. Now, he did so in a trolling kind of way, but he did so with very specific requests for pornographic material. So, for example, he would post comments about a mom's post of her five-year-old daughter wanting to learn photography and posting some of the photographs that the daughter had made. And he would say things like, hey, she did a great job with those photos. Now have her take these type of photos. And he would describe very pornographic acts. I'm not going to get into the details too much on this podcast, but they are really awful and disgusting. And you can read the opinion if you want to see exactly what he said to get a context of, you know, whether it appeared more trolling or whether it appeared like he really wanted to obtain these pornographic photos. But at any rate, law enforcement traced his IP address, as is done in almost every one of these cases. And during a search of his residence, they found more than 1,000 images of child pornography. And the images were of children of consistent ages with the children that he was soliciting photos of on the mom's blog. And they also found 24 pairs of children's underwear in his house, and no children lived at that residence. So they also found deleted file folders on his computer that was titled Babies and Potty Time. And that also was consistent with some of the posts on the mom blogs targeting mothers of infants using diapers. So the government charged him with one count of possession of child pornography and three counts of attempted production of child pornography. And a jury convicted him, and he was sentenced to 64 years in prison. So Mr. Moran appealed with an interesting argument, and I think that's why that led to this published decision. And basically, he argued that he was just trolling the mothers on the mom blog, and there was no real probability that they would actually send him pornographic images. So therefore, he isn't guilty of attempted production. So we have to start with the text of the statute, section 2251, subsection A, in relevant part. And that makes it unlawful for any person to employ, use, persuade, induce, entice, or coerce any minor to engage in any sexually explicit conduct for the purpose of producing any visual depiction of such conduct. And then it goes on to the interstate nexus portion of the statute. So Mr. Moran argued that the government couldn't prove that he had the specific intent to commit the crime because it wasn't even plausible that any mom blogger would have sent him pornographic images of their children. And therefore, it's clear that he was just internet trolling, and he did not intend to produce the child pornography. But the 11th Circuit smacked this argument down, finding that the desire alone is enough to establish intent. It doesn't matter if there is any likelihood of success, or none at all. If the government proves that you desired to produce child pornography, that's good enough for a conviction. The court also noted that he could have been trolling the moms, but he also could have desired the child pornography as well. Those two goals aren't mutually exclusive. And here the jury had Mr. Moran's posts, evidence of his sexual desire in children, and he made false exculpatory statements to police when confronted. The evidence that he asked for child pornography is evidence of his intent, even if his request was unlikely to result in the actual production of child pornography. So just asking for it is evidence that you desired it. Whether his request was unlikely to result in actual production of child pornography goes to the weight of that evidence. And in this case, Mr. Moran's posts were buttressed by the child pornography found in his home, the children's underwear found in his home, and his false statements to police. So trolling or not, Mr. Moran's conviction was upheld as the government does not have to prove that there was any likelihood of success to establish an attempted production of child pornography charges. Mr. Moran also challenged the interstate nexus requirement for the Section 2251A offense, and he argued that he must first know that there is a child pornography depiction before he can be convicted of knowing that it will travel in interstate commerce. But the 11th Circuit rejected this argument as well, and they held that for the interstate commerce nexus element, the government must only prove that if the child pornography were produced, it would have traveled in interstate commerce. So he's guilty even if the defendant doesn't know that there are child pornography visual depictions. So case affirmed. Our second case today is United States v. Pate. This is an 11th Circuit published decision that was released January 11th, 2023. Originally, Pate was a decision that was released back in August by a panel of the 11th Circuit, and that panel looked at 18 U.S.C. Section 1521, Obstruction of Justice, and the panel determined that the statute applies to false liens filed against both current and former federal officers and employees because of actions they performed while they were employed by the federal government. And in that opinion, Judge Newsom dissented, believing that the statute only applied to current federal officers and employees. So last week in this decision, the 11th Circuit vacated that decision and ordered that the case be heard en banc. So if you have a 1521 case relating to a former federal employee, keep an eye out for that decision because it should be coming down in the future en banc. So opinion vacated. Our third case today is Callan Zuri v. United States. This is an 11th Circuit unpublished decision that was released January 12, 2023. And Callan Zuri is a Medicare fraud case that resulted in a five-week trial. The case was upheld on appeal, actually three appeals, as this is the fourth time that Ms. Callan Zuri was before the 11th Circuit on this case. And Ms. Callan Zuri now appeals the denial of her 2251 motion to vacate. So the crux of her argument is that her attorney failed to call several witnesses in her defense and therefore rendered ineffective assistance of counsel. So I'm not going to get too far into the weeds on the facts of this case, but Ms. Callan Zuri co-owned and operated two businesses, a mental health facility and a nursing home. And the evidence established that she would use recruiters to find patients that didn't need psychiatric services, and then she would bill Medicare for those psychiatric services. Most of the patients were drug addicts and would receive cash payment for signing up. And there was evidence that co-conspirators falsified patient records to reflect false psychiatric problems. At trial, Ms. Callan Zuri argued that she acted in good faith and believed that the recruiters were providing lawful marketing services and even had lawyers draft contracts. As a little side note, and what was only a footnote in this opinion, the court describes an incident at trial that I thought was important to mention that is a little troubling. At trial, an agent testified that a falsified patient register was found on Ms. Callan Zuri's computer, and she denied at trial knowledge of that record being on the computer. So the prosecutor then impugned her credibility and argued that she wasn't credible. So it turns out after trial, the government finds out that a disc had been mislabeled and the falsified document was actually found on someone else's computer, not Ms. Callan Zuri's. And the prosecutor had attacked Ms. Callan Zuri's credibility at trial because she denied it. So despite this, what I think is a pretty major deal, the district court denied a motion for a new trial and the 11th Circuit previously affirmed finding that any error was harmless. Wow. But I digress. So back to this appeal, Ms. Callan Zuri argues that her counsel was ineffective because he implied in opening statement that he was going to call several witnesses. But then he only ended up calling Ms. Callan Zuri. She argued that there were several witnesses who would have provided exculpatory evidence. The attorney testified at a 2251 hearing at the trial court level, and he said that he decided to put Ms. Callan Zuri on the stand first to try and catch the government off guard, so they wouldn't have as much time to prepare for cross-examination and to whittle her credibility down. The attorney also testified that he decided not to call the other witnesses because he didn't think they would significantly move the needle and would provide the government with an opportunity to undermine Ms. Callan Zuri's testimony. The witnesses at issue would have testified that the company was well run, that it was not profitable enough to pay Ms. Callan Zuri the tens of millions of dollars the government alleged, that there were no falsifications or alterations known to the witnesses, that she complied with the government's request for documents, that Ms. Callan Zuri did not alter patient registers, and medical testimony that the patient charts were internally consistent and the patients were properly admitted. The magistrate judge recommended denial of the 2251 motion, finding certain witnesses that testified at the hearing not credible, and finding that the evidentiary value of others was minimal. And the magistrate judge also found that there was no prejudice because there was no reasonable probability that the proffered evidence would have changed the outcome of the trial. The district court then approved of the magistrate judge recommendation and then denied the motion. So on appeal, the 11th Circuit found that the district court's findings were not clearly erroneous. The court went through each witness and found that there was no error in the magistrate's finding of lack of credibility for some of those witnesses and the finding that there was limited evidentiary value for each of the other witnesses. Therefore, the district court did not err in concluding that the proffered witnesses would not have changed the outcome of the trial. So, case affirmed. Our fourth case today is United States v. Cash. This is an 11th Circuit unpublished decision that was released January 12, 2023. And Cash is a safety valve and firearm enhancement case. Mr. Cash pled guilty to possession with intent to distribute 50 grams or more of methamphetamine, and he was sentenced to a 120-month mandatory minimum sentence. On appeal, he argues that the district court erred in applying the two-level firearm enhancement under Section 2D1.1 subsection B1, and in finding that he wasn't safety valve eligible under Section 3553F and Section 5C1.2 subsection A of the guidelines. So we start with the firearm enhancement. Section 2D1.1 subsection B1 provides that if a dangerous weapon, including a firearm, was possessed during a drug trafficking crime, there is a two-level enhancement. And the commentary to that guideline states that the enhancement should be applied if the weapon was present, unless it is clearly improbable that it was connected with the offense. The government has the burden of proving the proximity of the weapon by a preponderance of the evidence, and if they do that, the burden then shifts to the defendant to show that a connection between the weapon and the offense was clearly improbable. Here, during a search of his residence, agents found a loaded handgun and 7 grams of methamphetamine together in a safe that was in Mr. Cash's upstairs bathroom. Unfortunately for Mr. Cash, 11th Circuit precedent establishes that proximity between guns and drugs, without more, is sufficient to meet the government's initial burden. So the burden shifts to Mr. Cash to show that it is clearly improbable that the gun that was found right next to the meth was connected to the possession with intent to distribute that meth. Mr. Cash cited United States v. Stallings, where police found 3 handguns in the defendant's home, and the court reversed the district court's application of the enhancement because there was no nexus beyond mere possession between the firearms and the drug crime. But in the Stallings case, there was no drug paraphernalia found in the home, only the gun, and there was no evidence that any of the conspiracy to distribute the drugs took place in that home. And the government didn't prove that the firearms belonged to Mr. Stallings, as there were 3 other adults who lived in that house. However, in Mr. Cash's case, it was undisputed that the gun belonged to Mr. Cash, and it was stored with the drugs in the same house where Mr. Cash engaged in drug activity. So Stallings was distinguished. And it doesn't matter if Mr. Cash had the guns forever, and he didn't brandish it during any of the drug sales or discuss it during any of the drug sales, because it is enough that one of the reasons drug dealers have guns is for self-defense based on the heightened danger of violence from selling the drugs. So the firearm enhancement sticks. But what about the safety valve issue? If Mr. Cash is safety valve eligible, he gets a 2-level reduction and breaks the mandatory minimum so the judge can sentence him under the 120-month mandatory minimum. But one of the eligibility requirements is that the defendant did not possess a firearm or other dangerous weapon in connection with the offense. And it is the defendant who must prove this by a preponderance of the evidence for the safety valve eligibility. And you may be thinking, if he got the firearm enhancement, wouldn't he automatically not be eligible for safety valve? But not so fast. Just because the Section 2D1.1 subsection B1 firearm enhancement applies doesn't necessarily mean the defendant possessed a firearm in connection with the offense for safety valve purposes. The burden's lower. But the defendant must still show that it is more likely than not that his possession of the firearm was not in connection with the offense. Unfortunately for Mr. Cash, the 11th Circuit found that he was not able to meet that burden, where the drugs and the gun were found so close together in his bathroom safe. So case affirmed. Our fifth case today is United States v. Harrison. This is an 11th Circuit published decision that was released January 10th, 2022. Harrison is a case about whether Georgia's robbery statute is divisible and whether it qualifies as a crime of violence. Mr. Harrison was charged with armed robbery in Georgia. He pled guilty to the lesser-included offense of robbery by intimidation. He was later federally indicted for possession of a firearm by a convicted felon under 922G. His base offense level increases to 20 when the defendant has a prior felony conviction for either a crime of violence or a controlled substance offense. So his guideline range ended up being 37 to 46 months in his PSR. At the trial level, Mr. Harrison argued to the district court that the Georgia robbery statute is indivisible and the least culpable conduct within that statute, robbery by sudden snatching, is not a crime of violence, and therefore his robbery conviction is not a crime of violence. The district court agreed with him and found that his robbery conviction was not a crime of violence and his guidelines were reduced to 21 to 27 months. The government appealed to the 11th Circuit, and they argued that the robbery statute is divisible and the trial court can determine which portion of the statute Mr. Harrison was convicted of, which was robbery by intimidation, therefore making it a crime of violence. So Georgia's robbery statute states that a person commits the offense of robbery when, with the intent to commit theft, he takes property of another from the person or the immediate presence of another, number one, by the use of force, number two, by intimidation, by the use of threat or coercion, or by placing such person in fear of immediate serious bodily injury to himself or to another, or number three, by sudden snatching. So if this statute is indivisible, we use a categorical approach, and we must look at the least culpable conduct that a person can be convicted of, which here is sudden snatching. If that least culpable conduct is not a crime of violence, then the conviction cannot be considered a crime of violence, no matter what the defendant actually did or was actually accused of. But if the statute is divisible, we use the modified categorical approach, and we still can't look at what the defendant actually is accused of or what he did, but we can look at the Shepherd documents to determine which portion of the statute he was convicted of. So here, if the statute is divisible, we would look at whether he was convicted of robbery by use of force, robbery by intimidation, or robbery by sudden snatching. Here, Mr. Harrison contends that the use of force, intimidation, or sudden snatching are all only alternatives listed and not different elements of the offense. The government argues that the statute sets apart three separate offenses. Both the government and Mr. Harrison agree that robbery by sudden snatching is not a crime of violence. So if the statute is divisible and we use the modified categorical approach, the government wins. If the statute is not divisible and we use the categorical approach, Mr. Harrison wins. A statute is divisible if it lists separate elements as opposed to separate means. To determine whether a statute includes elements or means, we first look to authoritative sources of state law. If the question isn't answered, we move to the record of conviction or Shepherd documents, including the indictment and jury instructions and other items that are the record of conviction. If the question is still not answered, the court will find the statute indivisible and use the categorical approach. Here, the 11th Circuit determined that the Georgia robbery statute sets forth separate elements and therefore is divisible. First, the court noted that Georgia's armed robbery statute includes robbery by intimidation as a lesser included offense, but excludes robbery by force and robbery by sudden snatching, therefore indicating that it's a separate offense within the robbery statute. The court also found that Georgia case law defines robbery by force, robbery by intimidation, and robbery by sudden snatching differently. So for these reasons, the court found that the Georgia statute is divisible. But the court went further and noted that in Harrison's case, the conviction noted robbery by intimidation rather than just robbery. And the pattern jury instructions tailor the instructions to each separate form of robbery, each indicating separate elements as opposed to separate means. So the court next determined whether robbery by intimidation is a crime of violence. Section 4B1.2 subsection A2 specifically includes robbery as an enumerated crime of violence. But if Georgia's robbery statute is broader than the federal definition, generic definition of robbery, then Georgia's robbery by intimidation would not be a crime of violence. Here, however, the 11th Circuit determined that Georgia's robbery by intimidation falls squarely within the federal generic definition of robbery. It requires property be taken from the person or the immediate presence of another by intimidation, which is defined as that terror likely to create an apprehension of danger and induce a person to part with his property for the safety of his person. So that's good enough, says the 11th. So case vacated and remanded. Our sixth case today is United States v. Madden. This is an 11th Circuit unpublished decision that was released January 13th, 2023. Madden is an engaging in a pattern of activity involving sexual abuse or exploitation of a minor enhancement case. And I didn't think we could get any more bizarre than the Moran mom blog internet troll case that we talked about earlier, but here we go. Mr. Madden was arrested for charges related to child pornography, and if you're an animal lover, I'd cover your ears right about now, for videos of him having sex with an animal. To make matters worse, he was a veterinarian. For these transgressions, Mr. Madden was sentenced to 262 months in prison. On appeal, Mr. Madden argues that the district court erred by applying a 5-level enhancement to his guidelines for engaging in a pattern of activity involving the sexual abuse or exploitation of a minor. So like so many of these cases, Mr. Madden appeared on a law enforcement's radar when they found online storage folders with child pornography, and then they tracked it back to him. During a search of his home, agents found 2 cell phones that contained child pornography and videos of Mr. Madden molesting dogs. They also found messages on his phone to a friend where he stated he had sex with children on multiple occasions. Some of the messages talked about a boy who turned 16 in 2019 and who Mr. Madden claimed to have had sex with during the last 2 years. At the sentencing hearing, an agent testified that there was a video of Mr. Madden having sex with a 15-year-old, and that victim stated that the sex had occurred 2 or 3 times before with Mr. Madden. The agent concluded that the victim was under 16 when the victim had sex multiple times with Mr. Madden. So the district court applied the pattern of activity enhancement over Mr. Madden's objection. A pattern of activity is defined as any combination of 2 or more separate instances of conduct prohibited under various statutes, which includes Section 2243, which prohibits engaging in a sexual act with another person between the ages of 12 and 16. Mr. Madden argues that the victim couldn't remember how many times they had sex, couldn't pinpoint when they had sex, that his messages to his friend were simply bragging, and that the video was the only evidence that supported only 1 instance of sexual conduct with a victim before the victim turned 16. But the 11th Circuit was unconvinced. The victim testified that they had sex multiple times before the victim turned 16, and even if the victim couldn't remember details, it doesn't matter. The district court was free to determine that the victim's statements were sufficient to establish a pattern of activity of sexual abuse. So, case affirmed. Our 7th and final case today is United States v. Miller. This is an 11th Circuit unpublished decision that was released January 11, 2023. Miller is a 922G possession of a firearm by a convicted felon case involving the legality of a traffic stop. A detective in an undercover car saw Mr. Miller conduct what the officer believed was a drug sale with the passenger. The detective saw Mr. Miller roll through a stop sign and called the marked unit to make a traffic stop for failing to come to a complete stop at a stop sign. During the traffic stop, Mr. Miller appeared nervous and there was a large bulge in his front pocket, which the detective believed could be a gun. So the detective asked Mr. Miller for his driver's license and gave that license to the uniformed officer to check for warrants. The detective then ordered Mr. Miller to get out of the car, and Mr. Miller initially refused. But after 4 more orders, Mr. Miller eventually complied and got out of the car. At that time, the detective was advised that Mr. Miller had an outstanding warrant. The detective conducted a Terry pat-down search and found that the bulge in Mr. Miller's pocket was in fact a gun. Mr. Miller was handcuffed and the gun was removed, and he was arrested and charged with possession of a firearm by a convicted felon under Section 922G. Mr. Miller went to trial and he was convicted. On appeal, Mr. Miller argues that the traffic stop and the duration of the stop was unlawful. However, his attorney didn't move to suppress the evidence and didn't object to the admission of the firearm. and there was no good cause why he didn't raise these issues at the trial level at the appropriate time. Therefore, he didn't preserve the issues for appeal. Mr. Miller also appealed the denial of his motion for judgment of acquittal, but the 11th Circuit found that the evidence was sufficient to sustain the conviction. After all, they did find the firearm in his pocket. So, case affirmed. And that's a wrap. I'm your host, Jeremy Lesnetsky with Lesnetsky Guy on Law, and this was another episode of the Site of the Crime podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please hit the like button. And if you'd like to keep up to date on all the latest criminal law cases, subscribe to the Site of the Crime. And if you like the show, please review us. This will help your colleagues find us, and they too can stay up to date. Each week, we'll release separate Florida and federal criminal law episodes with the previous week's court opinions. Look in the show notes for links to each case and for a link to the written case summaries. If you have questions or comments, please don't hesitate to shoot me an email at jeremy@lglawflorida.com. See you next time at the Site of the Crime.